Emergency room visits are skyrocketing from the use of dangerous energy drinks. Are you next in line, suffering from fatigue, tiredness, or seeking peak performance? Real energy.
Real.
My fatigue was obliterated with a groundbreaking new product called Ultra Rush. I feel the rush, and the best part is I've got real energy for peak performance. Ultra Rush cracked the code to energy. Recently published studies show that ingredients found together only in Ultra Rush increased energy an average of 45% in patients with chronic fatigue, and athletes experienced a 40% increase in stamina. Now that's energy. Visit UltraRush.com, UltraRush.com, ALTERRush.com. Free trial samples are available for a limited time. Get moving again with Ultra Rush, ALTERRush.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. Not intended to treat, diagnose, prevent, or cure disease. Results may vary.
Hey, y'all, are you looking for Clarilla? Some chocolate superfood with organic vanilla. Food-based vitamins keep you a healthy fella. Use your wife's credit card, don't even have to tell her. Go to Natural News Store, that's what it's there for. Get your superfoods, herbs, and a lot more. Feel young like you did before, and let Mother Nature's medicine work it like it's there for. I know you care for your health, therefore. Don't eat those GMOs, throw them out the back door. Don't stay poor with your diet if it's killing you. Enjoy your life with nutrition that's filling you. We got freeze-dried fruit that's organic. Super clean, superfoods, best on the planet. Blueberry, strawberry, even pomegranate. Yeah, it's ready to ship, and if you buy it, you can have it. Yeah, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. Check out store.naturalnews.com for all your organic supplements and superfoods. Or call 888-959-6415. That's 888-959-6415 to order now. Coconut, maca, spirulina, goji berry, superfood protein.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files anytime you want to listen on your phone, mobile devices, or personal computer. When you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening.
Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency, for we must be the masters of our destiny. Let freedom ring throughout the land.
Welcome. You're listening to the Know Your Rights Hour with co-hosts Dr. Sherry Tenpenny and vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, now proudly sponsored by the Natural Farm Source in tribute to the late Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Go to homefirst.com, click on the store button for your source for vitamins A, vitamin C, and probiotics to stay healthy naturally. We are live every Monday evening on blogtalkradio.com/KnowYourRightsHour. At 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, 7 Mountain, and 6 Pacific times. And we are proudly rebroadcast at naturalnewsradio.com Wednesdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain, and 10 a.m. Pacific time. We welcome your calls during the live show. That number is area code 646-478-0772. That number again, 646-478-0772. You can call in just to listen to the show by phone, or punch 1, and we'll try to get to you if you have questions or comments you want to add to the discussion. And you can email us during the week. Those email addresses are drtenpenny@gmail.com. That's drtenpenny@gmail.com and attorney@vaccinerights.com, attorney@vaccinerights.com. We will try to get your emails, but due to the volume, you may not get a personal response. But please email us anyway. And let's see, where are we at? This is January 19th, 2015. I'm Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips. And with me now weekly, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. Sherry, it's great being back with you again. How are you doing this evening?
Thanks so much, Alan. What a great introduction. And it's always a pleasure to be here. And I think we're going to have more fun each week as time goes on.
And our own special brand of fun, no doubt.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Sherry, I wanted to just ask you real quick before we jump into some other topics, any updates on the Pharma Australia situation, or has that cooled down any?
Oh, it hasn't cooled down at all. In fact, I just got notification right before I got home tonight from the writer who interviewed me a couple of weeks ago in a pretty long Skype interview, that the article was just released today just to Vice in Australia. And so that's a pretty high-end, very visible magazine. And so I think that some of the media is going to start over again. I still haven't heard anything about my visa, and I know that Stephanie Messenger and the other people in Australia are working hard to find additional venues.
Well, you know, we all are very curious, anxious and eager to, you know, hear any updates when you have them. So we hope you'll bring those to us each week here as we close in on your scheduled trip in late February, I think you said.
Yeah, so we're supposed to leave here February 25th and be back later in the month. Yep.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to hearing more about this. But what a wonderful thing, though, as we pointed out last week, and you've been saying that. Well, of course, you would have been happy just to go quietly in and talk to a few hundred people and have your vacation and get home. Instead, we're getting a tremendous attention brought to this issue internationally, not even just in Australia. So good for you, good for the issue, and we'll be curious, of course, to hear how this plays out more over time. But, boy, there's been no shortage of other things going on in the news recently, has there?
No. You know, that's one thing that I think we've talked about this before, that at least, at the very least, keeps me very interested in this topic, is because it's never boring. There's always something going on. So a new vaccine, a new adjuvant, a new lawsuit, a new something that the pharmaceutical industry is trying to pull, a new topic, a new angle, that they are forever trying to weasel into our pocketbooks, and trying to get their pills and potions injected into our bodies and swallowed into our stomachs. So there's always things that are going on, and it's always interesting to be able to wake many more thousands and thousands of people up so that they realize and become enlightened as to what's going on, and they can keep their families and their children and themselves healthy, most often without using any kind of drugs at all.
We are definitely making progress, but they're certainly not going down without a fight. So I feel like this is going to, you know, it's like one of the metaphors I use, I say the train keeps rolling down the tracks. Well, there's another train in the other direction, you know, as you're referring to the growing awareness. I wonder if there's going to be a head-on collision at some point, or if maybe we're not already seeing aspects of that. But I tell you, I am committed to truth and integrity, even more so in 2015, if that's possible, than I have been before. And I'm going to do my best to be polite and professional and discreet when necessary, but to be direct and honest whenever I feel it's most important. And this is an issue, the vaccine issue, that's playing out on multiple levels. Sort of fascinating. When you step back and look at that, and I don't even think most of us in the alternative community are really aware of how many different levels are all going on at different times contemporaneously or at the same time. But let's jump to a topic. I know you had asked me since the last show about a recent court case in New York, and I wanted just to reassure people this is a case that was originally filed in federal district court in New York, went up on appeal to the Second Circuit. And just very briefly, Sherry, let me give people a thumbnail sketch about the court system structure so people understand what that means when we say a case went up to the Second Circuit. Every state has its own state court system, and then there is a completely separate federal court system. And there are certain kinds of disputes that are purely state law issues. They'll never be, you'll never see them fought out in a federal court, and vice versa, certain kinds of federal issues that you'll never see in a state court. And then there's certain issues that could be in either state or federal court for various reasons. Well, issues concerning vaccine religious exemptions, you're usually starting, and they were in this case, with a state religious exemption law. So ultimately, they could have filed the case in state court or federal court. But the reason, the way that it could get into federal court is that religious exemptions involve federal First Amendment rights. So you have an option with vaccine exemption cases, religious exemption cases. And there are cases around the country. Some have been filed in state courts and some have been filed in federal courts. But every state's divided into one or more federal districts. And when you hear somebody talking about a federal district court, that's a trial court. And every state has its system of trial courts as well. When a case goes up on appeal in the federal court system, it goes to a circuit court. And the country is divided into 11 numbered circuits, where every circuit has anywhere from 3 to 9 states in it. So the Second Circuit, I believe, has 3 New England states, New York and 2 other states in it. So anyway, this case lost in federal district court. It was appealed to the Second Circuit and lost there as well. And I think a lot of people have been really concerned that maybe we have lost some rights connected with vaccine religious exemptions. And I just want to assure everybody that all this case really did was to reestablish the status quo. Individual states are not required by the Constitution to even provide a religious exemption. 48 states have laws that either explicitly provide a religious exemption or have language that would encompass religious objections, which I find pretty amazing, really, when you consider that the states are not required to offer a religious exemption and how powerful the pharmaceutical lobby is. And we keep hearing noise from time to time from Paul Offit and others about how we should eliminate all non-medical exemptions. And yet, freedom of religion apparently is strong enough in this country that even though people, a majority of people, are not asking for religious exemptions to be on the books, I think a state, any of the states that have religious exemption, if they were to try to remove the religious exemption, I think that would be of great concern to anybody concerned with religious freedom generally, because I think they would see that as an encroachment on religious freedom generally, even if they weren't necessarily in favor of a vaccine religious exemption or didn't care if there was a vaccine religious exemption. So I think it'd be hard to get rid of, and I hope nobody proves me wrong on this, I think it would be hard for states to get rid of their religious exemptions. Far easier for them to go after the philosophical exemptions, although a couple of recent attempts to do that have met with some really firm resistance, I'm happy to say. So that's just sort of a real quick overview or thumbnail sketch there. I don't think that Second Circuit case that originated in New York has taken away any rights. All it really has done is to reaffirm that the current law is constitutional. Now, there were many claims, separate claims made in the case, and there were a couple of them that I think had the potential to have to be winning claims. And my impression from reading the court opinion, I haven't read any briefs or the original complaint that was filed in the case, so I can't speak to any of that. But based on the court's written opinion, it sounds to me like the case just was ill-conceived. It wasn't really put together well. There were some claims that really just weren't valid claims, And at least based on the court's opinion, the couple of claims that I think might have been valid appear just not to have been presented effectively. But that's at most only a preliminary assessment on my part. The main thing, though, is we haven't lost any rights. We just haven't gained any that at least hypothetically we might have.
Hmm. Well, thanks for explaining that, Alan, because I think that a lot of people in New York are always very concerned about their exemption rights because, as you well know, New York only has a medical exemption and a religious exemption, and it's a very tough religious exemption. And I would say that New York has probably the most difficult, one of the most difficult jurisdictions to get a medical exemption in any part of the country. And we're constantly getting phone calls and emails from parents there that want help in that state. And so it's good to, and recently they just passed these, they're talking about mandating the flu shot for kindergartners. I believe that was in New York and New Jersey. And so they're getting more and more militant with this. So it's good to know that when that case came out, because I found it disturbing when I sent it to you, and thank you for the explanation, because I was disturbed that they had crossed the line and that they were trying to set a precedent to remove religious exemptions across the country. So it is definitely reassuring to know that that would be quite difficult to do.
New York is a really interesting state with regard to the school vaccine religious exemption. New York, like many states, originally had a law requiring membership in an organized religion. And many states have had those a similar kind of law in the past. There are still at least two that I'm aware of, maybe more states that still have that kind of a law in the books. Every time those laws have been challenged in court, they've been found to be unconstitutional, and the states have had to fix them. But New York, when that issue went up in New York, went to court, the court took an unprecedented step that other states didn't do when the same issue went to court. In New York, the federal court actually directed the state to rewrite the exemption to make it constitutional.
Hmm.
And it was probably a factor, and the reason other states haven't approached their ruling in the same way probably has to do with the way the laws are written individually in every state. You know, every state words their laws their own way. So it may have been something that just had to do with the unique wording, specific wording in New York. But it was a real interesting ruling, and then, of course, the state did that. And there is legal precedent on vaccine religious exemptions here and there, a smattering around the country, but most of the precedent is out of New York, is in New York courts, and many of the ones that help to define, really for the whole country, where the boundaries are in terms of what does and doesn't qualify, were cases in New York federal district courts. And I had an occasion a few weeks ago to be on the phone with an attorney in New York, and I was talking about this, and I asked, just as kind of a side issue, almost more of a rhetorical question. I wasn't even really necessarily expecting an answer. And I said, why is all the precedent, you know, most of this precedent coming out in New York? And he did answer me, and he says, oh, yeah, we've got lots of rich people in this district who can afford to, you know, take their cases to court and take it up on appeal and so forth. But it's sort of interesting because when precedent comes from a particular court, the precedent is only binding on that particular court's jurisdiction. So when federal district courts in New York have been making these rulings on here are the boundaries on vaccine religious exemptions, it's not by any means irrelevant to the rest of the country, but it's what's called persuasive precedent. So courts in other jurisdictions around the U.S. could rule differently on those same issues if they wanted to. As a practical matter, they haven't been doing that. They've been going by the New York precedent. But my point, Sherry, is this. That precedent is binding in New York, where technically it's not anywhere else in the country. So the law is more clear in New York than anywhere else. And yet New York seems to be the place where there's the most litigation, where the schools are the most aggressive, and the laws are written differently everywhere, but in New York, the individual schools have authority to scrutinize the beliefs of parents who are requesting exemption, and they get to decide. And this kind of, on a common sense level, bizarre reality, because the law does not always follow common sense, but in this point, I think it does. You know, the practical reality is, well, of course, all the schools throughout the state of New York are not going to apply the same criteria evenly and fairly and properly and consistent with all the other schools in the state. And so this gives rise to a legitimate constitutional concern, because states are required under the federal constitution to apply their laws fairly and evenly to anybody in the state that's in the same or similar situation. But in order to challenge that effectively in court, you're going to have an example of where it hasn't been applied. I don't know if that's what went wrong in this recent case or not. But you're going to have someone to come in who's going to testify and say, in effect, you'd have to have two different people who had very similar statements, religious belief statements, where one was accepted and the other was denied, something like that. So you could have evidence and not just a theory that the law is not being applied fairly and evenly. But it's the kind of thing that, if the case is put together right, ought to be fairly straightforward to demonstrate. Again, how a court rules is always a roll of the dice to one degree or another, which is one of the reasons I'm a big fan of legislation as a way of addressing some of these issues. But because, Sherry, even if you come in with a winning argument, and I hate to say, but I've seen this in court cases when I've worked with litigators. I'm not a litigator myself. I'm a consultant, but I consult with litigators a lot in my work. And I've seen them take in winning, what I believe are winning arguments, and the court judges, vast majority of them anyway, being steeped in pro-vaccine views, are just reluctant sometimes to follow the law. Now, I've met some wonderful judges and attorneys, don't get me wrong, but I have, and one of the reasons I don't go to court anymore is because you can do everything the right way and you still have no idea what's going to happen. You can have a slam dunk case where the other side blatantly is not doing what they're supposed to do or following the law or whatever, and you still never know what's going to happen. And I just reached a point where I couldn't keep telling my clients, yes, you should have won. I have no idea what the judge was thinking. You still have to pay me. So I'm going to leave it to the thicker-skinned people who can handle, you know, litigation in that respect. But I do think most judges most of the times try to do the right thing. But in this is an arena where they will step over the law to get to the outcome they want on some occasions. And so, again, a lot of these issues, I think, are better addressed legislatively.
Why do you think that, Alan, why do you think that is? I mean, you know, why do you think that judges, even though they see, aren't they supposed to rule on the preponderance of evidence? Or is it because, and this is a statement that I've made sometimes, I hope it was correct when I said that, it's because judges are supposed to uphold existing law and existing public opinion. They aren't supposed to create new laws. Is that correct?
Well, there are some issues that are decided purely as a matter of law. It is simply a legal argument or a legal question, and you put respective sides or attorneys will put forth their legal arguments, and the judge decides which one is the better argument, or potentially comes up with a third position and says, here's the ruling. But as to matters that concern evidence, then there are different standards in civil courts. It just sort of depends on what specific issue it is, but sometimes it's just more likely than not preponderance of the evidence. Other times it's what's the phrase I'm looking for here? There are different levels that are some stronger than others, and it just depends on exactly what kind of case it is. And then none of them are as strict a standard as in criminal court, because where someone's liberty is at risk, the theory is we'd rather let a guilty person go free than an innocent person be convicted. And so you've got that beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which is higher than any of the civil court standards. But there was another point now. I just lost track of it to your question. Remind me again, please, because there was another important point there.
That were judges supposed to make, are they supposed to just uphold the law and not make new law?
This is a really good question and a really good point. I think there's some ongoing debate about that. When I was in law school, I was instructed early on that there are different sources of law, and that includes judge-made law. That was the phrase I was given. So I think there's debate about where judicial authority stops, and that not everybody agrees on that. But generally speaking, they are supposed to interpret the law and not certainly not invent from scratch. But for example, sometimes in interpreting the law, judges will, I don't know how much sense this will make speaking in kind of abstract terms, but they may carve out an exception. You know, I'll give you a hypothetical example because I don't know of this happening anywhere, but let's say somebody wanted to refuse only those vaccines that were cultured on aborted human fetal cells on religious grounds. And let's say the wording of the statute, the religious exemption statute, seems to pretty clearly say all or nothing. You either have beliefs opposed to vaccines or you don't. Then if the person says, well, I don't mind some of them, I just don't want the ones that have aborted fetal cells connected with them, and I can't have any of those for religious reasons, which I think is a perfectly valid and viable position. In fact, there was a case in New York where somebody had that position and they pursued it, and the health department basically backed off and let them have the exemption for just those some vaccines. But, you know, somebody could potentially say, depending again on the specific wording of the law, well, that's not an option here. And so let's say they deny the exemption. And let's say the woman goes to court, and let's say the court says, well, based, you know, it's a nice idea, we like it, but based on the wording of the law, we can't let you do that. And so the trial court says you lose. And so she takes it up on appeal. Well, it may be that the appellate court has authority that the trial court didn't have, that the appellate court can say, well, we're going to carve out an exception here. We're going to say that even though the wording of the law doesn't allow for this particular option, that because this can be, and in this particular instance, is a valid religious belief, that it does have protection from the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which has the so-called free exercise clause referring to the free exercise of religion. And the appellate court then makes a decision saying this person gets the exemption, and in saying so, is saying that here's an exception to the usual wording of the law. So, and this is a really, brings up a really important, more general point, Sherry, because we the starting place for many legal issues is going to be a state statute or federal statute, or maybe a regulation from state or federal health department, for example. But attorneys will almost never stop at just that point. They will go look at legal precedent, which comes from actual past court cases, where we see here's how the courts have interpreted this law in various situations, whatever situations have gone to court and generated legal precedent in the past. You don't really know what a law means, and from the point of view of an attorney anyway. You often don't know what a law means unless you also go look at the court cases where courts have interpreted the law and said, here's how it applies in these different situations. Then you have a much better understanding of what the law is. Because while we're all free, for example, that... Go ahead.
Well, how often do they change their mind? Or do they ever? I mean, do they ever say, based on new evidence, what we decided in the past, was this was the way we were going to interpret this law or this statute or this ruling in the past. Now, based on new evidence, we're going to overturn that and say, you know, we don't think that's true anymore. That isn't really doesn't really apply to the current state, which then circles back to Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And I know there's been a lot of things written about that. And, you know, Mary Holland has written extensively about it, and I've read a fair amount of it, even though I'm obviously a doctor and not a lawyer. But, you know, the overturning of things based on new evidence and not continuing to maintain an entire industry wrapped around a law that was passed in, what was that, 1902 or 1907? So here we are.
1905, yeah, so.
Oh, more than 100 years later, we are creating, we continue to say the right of the state to put as much stuff into your body at our will because we said so supersedes your right to say, but wait a minute, I have an autoimmune disease and I don't think I should have that.
So, again, just really, really good question, Sherry. And this is what one of the things that this second opinion, I mean, the circuit court opinion we were just talking about a little while ago, one of the things that the attorney in this case was trying to do. And the court opinion very clearly explains that the court, and going back to the Jacobson case as precedent to support the court's opinion, and for what it's worth, I agree with the court in this case, saying that because, again, what the plaintiffs in this case were trying to do is saying, well, look, there's, you know, this enormous amount of evidence now that says vaccines do more harm than good. She wanted to, or they wanted to bring this that issue up in the context of a court case. And the court, in its court opinion, explains, citing Jacobson as precedent to support their position, that the court does not have authority to second-guess the state legislature. And if the legislature says that vaccines are necessary and passes a law mandating them, then the court cannot challenge that. In other words, that is a perfectly valid issue. It's core, you know, front and center in a big way to the whole vaccine controversy, that there's just more and more evidence showing more and more serious problems with vaccines, calling them in question. But the bottom line is that's an issue for us to take to the legislature. The court doesn't have authority to address that issue in a court case. Now, the legal system, the reason we go look at precedent to see how courts have interpreted things is because our legal system on the whole strives for consistency. Judges can't just, supposedly anyway, rule according to their personal opinion or whims or wishes. If they're going to do their job correctly, they're going to rule consistent with prior rulings. And the point of this is that our legal system strives for a reasonable amount of predictability. If judges' decisions were just random based on each judge's personal opinions, decisions would be all over the place. Now, do courts always have to rule according to prior cases? No. From time to time, courts will rule in a way that's contrary to prior precedent, and they will, in effect, overturn prior precedent. Now, not just any court can do that anytime they want to. That would be certain appellate courts. And depending on what court opinion is being overruled, for example, if the Supreme Court has ruled on something, it would probably take the Supreme Court itself to change its own prior precedent. So, you know, good luck getting a trial court to do that. But because if there's precedent from a higher court, the trial court is bound by that, and even appellate courts are sometimes bound by or would be bound by a higher appellate court's previous rulings. So, again, part of the issue here is it concerns a strategy for those of us in the alternative community. How do we approach various issues? There are certain kinds of issues that really just aren't good court cases for any number of possible reasons that are probably better addressed legislatively. You lose a court case, you potentially generate legal precedent going in the different direction than you want it to go. If you try to get something passed by a state legislature and it doesn't get passed, you can come back the next legislative cycle and try again. And some people will spend, you know, years or even decades getting something finally passed. There's a second question about what do you address at the state level and what do you address at the federal level. But, Sherry, we need to take a break here and get our ads in here. And let me go ahead and go to that. We're just running just a little bit behind on that. We've had somebody who's been waiting very patiently through the show. And let's, Sherry, if you're in agreement, let's come back after the break here and bring in that caller. And we'll go from there. Sound good to you?
Yes, sounds good to me. Yes, sorry.
Oh, okay.
I temporarily had you on a mute there. That's perfectly – sorry about that.
No, no, that's fine. I thought we'd lost you. All right. We're going to go to break here. You've been listening to the Know Your Rights Hour. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, Attorney Alan Phillips. We'll be right back, so please stick around.
Emergency room visits are skyrocketing from the use of dangerous energy drinks. Are you next in line, suffering from fatigue, tiredness, or seeking peak performance? Real energy. Real. My fatigue was obliterated with a groundbreaking new product called Ultra Rush. I feel the rush, and the best part is I've got real energy for peak performance. Ultra Rush cracked the code to energy. Recently published studies show that ingredients found together only in Ultra Rush increased energy an average of 45% in patients with chronic fatigue, and athletes experienced a 40% increase in stamina. Now that's energy. Visit AlterRush.com, AlterRush.com, AlterRush.com. Free trial samples are available for a limited time. Get moving again with AlterRush, AlterRush.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA, not intended to treat, diagnose, prevent, or cure disease. Results may vary.
The Natural News Store is now open. Hi, this is Joni Cox with Homegrown Health with some great news for your health and your budget. Visit shopnaturalnews.com to start saving money right now on superfoods like cacao, camu camu, and acai. You'll find coconut flour, coconut sugar, and hemp seeds, as well as detox products like Zeotrex, Oxy Powder, and Nascent Iodine. You'll also find survival organic food supplies and colloidal silver. Both can help you prepare for natural disasters or other events that might threaten your health or safety. As Hurricane Sandy recently taught America, just one storm can knock out the power grid and leave us all scrambling for food and medicine. We've also got amazing herbal medicine cabinets and herbal survival kits. Plus, we're the exclusive source for the all-new Natural Attitude Turmeric Extract. It's a powerful, alcohol-free, liquid form of turmeric with high absorbability. Plus, get free shipping in the USA on orders of $99 or more. A portion of all sales helps fund health freedom and food freedom initiatives. Find all this and much more at shopnaturalnews.com. That's shopnaturalnews.com.
Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery. And our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WebSeed.com.
Okay, we're back with the Know Your Rights Hour with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny and Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips. We've got a caller who's been waiting very patiently. Area code 215, you are on the air, and thank you for your patience.
Good evening, Dr. Tenpenny, and good evening, Attorney Alan. This is Catherine Frompovich.
Catherine.
Oh, hello.
Yes, how are you, everybody? I would like to share with you that I appreciate your work, and I think it's very valuable and very needed. But I'm calling tonight because I'd like to bring in something into the vaccine discussion that I don't think has ever maybe been addressed by anybody. And can we have a try at it?
Sure.
Okay. why is it not a mandatory procedure for when anyone dies or has some very serious illness or accident or a health report being made, that as part of that report, vaccination dates and vaccines are not included?
Well, I know that back, I started into looking into the problems associated with vaccines in September of 2000, and it was around that time, maybe within the next year or so, that I met Sandy Mintz. Sandy who runs Vaccination News. And she, at one point in time, had actually tried to get that legislation entered into her state legislation, which I believe was in, at the time was in Alaska, and was not able to get that pushed forward so that all deaths, of, particularly of children, would their vaccination record would be filed with their death certificate. And to my knowledge, that's the only time that's ever been talked about or tried. So I do believe you're correct that that's a that's something that really needs to be changed.
But just not with deaths, Dr. Sherry, as a part of normal reporting. Anybody had an accident, anybody had a pneumonia. Whenever you go to the doctor, as part of your workup, the doctor, nurse, practitioner, emergency room, coroner, you know, whoever's filling out a death certificate, all that should be part of it because when you look into the records for poisonings and so on and so forth, it's all there that people die from various things, and I think it should be something that should be mainstreamed, and I think we should start asking the people in the alternative healthcare community and writing even letters to health magazines and so on and so forth to mainstream this idea, because once that starts getting going as a practice, I think more and more statistics can be gathered, also more and more mainstreamed information can be gotten out there with regard to maybe something really going on. Does that make sense or not?
Well, it does, and I will also say that I know that my good friend Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, when she was still in practice as a nephrologist in Maine, it was one of the things that she wanted to have on that, on medical records. And I do believe that she, once she started finding out or seeing that how many patients were admitted, you know, she's a nephrologist, which is a kidney doctor. And so the people were being admitted into the hospital every year, and within a week to 10 days that they had chronic renal disease, chronic kidney disease, and then they would get a flu shot and or a pneumonia shot, and they would go into kidney failure, and then they would need to go into the hospital and go on dialysis. And as soon as the dialysis sort of cleaned out their blood and cleaned them up, they would go back to their baseline. And she had done an investigation, and I don't remember how many charts she actually found this consistency with, but it was a fairly sizable number. And she went to her medical staff and said, because at that time, any patient that was being admitted into the hospital, there was a standing order that as soon as you were admitted, you were to get either a flu shot and or a pneumonia shot if you hadn't already had one. And so she was having, they would be administered by the pharmacist. And she was having to go to the hospital earlier and earlier to negate these standing orders off of her charts with her patients. And she remembered seeing one patient. She went in to see them on rounds, and the patient was sick and looking kind of guilty. And she said to the patient, what's the matter? And she said, well, I just had my pneumonia shot. And she said, why did you have that? I thought, well, we agreed, we talked about it. And the patient said, I was just so tired, and I didn't feel good, and they were in here so many times, and they just badgered me so much, I just finally had to just give in, and they let them do it. And so the vaccination records inside of the hospital, there is pressure, you know, from people who are already sick. I mean, in any other types of things that are happening, I do believe that you're absolutely right. I mean, because we don't even, and she said once she started asking the question, people would come to see her in her office, and I do this all the time in my office, but once she started seeing patients in the office, she would start taking as part of their normal medical history When was your last flu shot? When was your last pneumonia shot? Did you get a shingle shot? Have you had a hepatitis B vaccine? And the correlations between then and when they started being sick were amazing. That was one of the things that led Suzanne down the road to where she got to be, and she started opening up the eyes to some of her colleagues, but then again, they thought that it was crazy and just rather anecdotal types of things and would not ask their own patients the same question.
Well, for what it's worth, and for your listening audience, I think maybe we have put out some seeds, and I'd like to see everybody ask their doctors to make that a part of their charts and their medical records. And, oh, by the way, you know, the last time little Joey had his shot, then he was sick, you know, now it's 2 weeks since then, and so on and so forth. And I think parents should speak up and demand that it be part of the record. I don't know if you're familiar, but back in 2012, Norma Erickson and I got together guidelines for what to do for autopsy medical tests after children die, usually after vaccines. And that's another thing that parents ought to, educate themselves about. When your child dies within relatively recent, having had a vaccine or whatever, they should know what to do, and I don't think they don't. And that's very sad for the family, for the child, and for medicine per se.
You can't find what you're not looking for.
Right, right.
I'm sorry, I did not hear that.
I said you can't find what you're not looking for. And so if it's information you don't want to have, why would you collect it?
Yeah, and the reason that I paused, Catherine, when you first raised the question, because it's an absolutely critical point that you're raising here, but I had sort of three different answers going on at the same time, you know, in my mind, the short versions of which were, well, medically, this is absolutely a critical piece of information that you're talking about. Legally, I doubt that it's required anywhere, and politically, it's going to be an uphill battle to get it required. But I think the concept here is not only valid, I think it's a critical point, and I think it's a part of a collection of different aspects of this issue that all need to be advanced. And one aspect of advancing this, of course, is just awareness. So anyone who, in the ways that you're suggesting, Catherine, or other ways, anyone who can write articles about this, anything we can do to help raise awareness on this idea, I think is a good thing to do. And but ultimately, as with many other aspects of the vaccine issue, that awareness will need to be at some point translated into action in various forms, but in particular into legislative action. You know, I'm sure, now, Sherry, you probably know more about this than I do, and maybe you, Catherine, as well. I'm not familiar with autopsy guidelines or rules, but I would imagine that every state has health department regulations about the specific requirements for autopsies, for example. And Catherine, I know you were talking about more than just autopsies, but just as an example, you know, what would it take for us to get those regulations to be expanded to include a requirement that vaccination history and vaccination status, especially if it's recent, be something that's included as part of the record. But the larger point, if I understand you correctly, Catherine, is the idea of raising awareness of vaccines in connection, perhaps initially in terms of proximity and time, with many different injuries and deaths as well. Because one of the things, and just to validate what you're saying on another level, Catherine, I have talked with several of the attorneys who handle the vaccine injury and death cases under the federal vaccine injury compensation program, and they all report that they have people calling them all the time who didn't know anything about the program at all, and then it was too late. And by the time they're talking to an attorney, and it doesn't, you don't have to hire, these attorneys are paid by the federal government, so it doesn't cost anybody anything to have an attorney in one of these cases, so there's really no reason not to have an attorney And with most legal issues, especially something complicated like this, you want an attorney if you can get one. But these people, by the time they find out about it, they've missed the statute of limitations. They no longer have the ability to even file the petition in the first place, let alone to see if their petition is granted or not. And this is in large part, at least based on all the anecdotal reports I hear, that doctors will tell people, oh, no, it's just a coincidence. The vaccine had nothing to do with it. Well,
but
this,
may,
of course...
May I, excuse me, may I interrupt?
Well, let me finish the sentence, and then I'll back out of the way and let you guys jump right in. The point is that there seems to be, at best, a lack of awareness, but more likely a deliberate suppression of exactly the kind of information you're trying to bring awareness to. And so we've got to figure out, you know, not only how do we bring this to people's attention, but how do we overcome the deliberate attempt to keep this information suppressed? And one of the ways is to make it a requirement legally that the information be documented and considered.
Okay, and the perfect example and time, in my opinion, would be all these states, school districts, et cetera, that are requiring, and doctors, requiring that you parent has to be educated if they're going to be signing for exemptions or anything, or they have to go through an hour of videos about vaccines. That information has to be in there about theirs, about the court, about deaths, and so on and so forth. They won't tell people that stuff. And if it's to be truly informed about vaccines, that has to be included. And I would think that that would be the most logical step for any state legislature or legislator, once you talk to them and say, yeah, if that's only half of the information that a parent is getting as part of the indoctrination that we want them to take the vaccine or that they should know all the information about vaccine, well, half of it's missing.
I agree with you. I think you're absolutely right. In fact, I think there's a legal argument that the state constitutionally can't even require the education in the first place. But
I'm allowing them to do that, provided that they give the other half of the information.
Right, right. So there's two different possible approaches there. One is to say we're going to overlook the argument that you can't even do it at all in the first place, and we're going to let you do it, but we want you to do it fairly and give complete information. And
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That is,
you know,
that
you,
would be a terrific,
you know,
legislative agenda item.
Yeah, but one of the things would be the policing of this. I mean, we have laws on the books in all 50 states that require doctors to give out the VIS statement, right? I mean, it's absolutely required by law that they do that.
It's federal law, yeah, but they're required.
Yes, but they're required. And there have been several studies I've read over the years saying that a number of times that is actually given out is some dismally small number. And so we can't police the pediatrician's office and force them to give out the VIS statements. How could we legislatively require them to put the vaccine records in and police it, other than somehow it would have to be part of the record and be tied in with Obamacare or insurance reimbursement or something like that in order for it to be able to make it a viable option that is actually tracked with police?
I agree with you there, but I also and say that I think every state legislative body who mandates vaccines should have to mandate that doctors and anybody who's giving information out about vaccines has to give this, that, and the other thing that we just discussed.
And these are all critical legislative agenda items. So one of the ways that people can be legislatively active without having to take on an entire part-time job is to, which can be what it involves, or even a full-time job for paid lobbyists, is to join the National Vaccine Information Center's advocacy portal, the website NVIC advocacy.org. That's a website that is devoted solely to vaccine legislation, and you can monitor what's going on in terms of pending vaccine bills around the country and in your state, whatever state, you know, any person's in, and participate in the legislative process in an informed way, because a lot of this just goes on behind the scenes, and it's not like it's even necessarily covered up, but how many people have the time and knowledge to keep up continually with the legislation in their own state, let alone around the country? So the NVIC, and in particular Don Richardson, has gone to great lengths to try and make this something that all of us can do with a minimum amount of effort. But however we do it, ultimately this means being legislatively active, being in touch with our representatives, forming relationships with them, helping to educate them about these problems, and then asking for their help to get legislation introduced, either new laws or amendments to existing laws. These are all critical points. And you know, there are many, many different aspects of this issue that could be, and in my opinion anyway, need to be addressed legislatively. But part of the problem here, let me go back just to another point real quick here. Some of the laws that are on the books, like this federal law, it's actually part of the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act that requires doctors and others administering vaccines to minors to first give this information statement to the parent. And as you point out, Catherine, they're just not doing it. Well, I've looked at this law, and I see nothing in the law that creates a penalty for doctors if they don't do it. So they cannot do it and nothing happens. There's a similar thing in the wording of this law, that the pharmaceutical industries are supposed to be making a good faith effort to create safer vaccines. But if there's no liability and there's no penalty for not creating a safer vaccine, are they going to spend any time and money on that? Of course not. I mean, as a business decision. Now, you know, we can talk about ethics and morality, but this is an industry that routinely engages in massive criminal behavior. Criminal fines in the pharmaceutical industry, criminal now, not just civil, but criminal mm-hmm. fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars are common.
And billions.
And even and billions. Pfizer in 2009, mm-hmm. Who was it, and Glaxo in 2012, billion-dollar
yeah,
criminal
billions.
Fines.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an industry that state governments should be partnering with, and that's part of the argument that I put in the information that I create for state legislators, is that this is an industry that routinely engages in criminal behavior, and you as a legislator and the legislature should not be partnering with this kind of an industry.
But money talks, so, you know that. Lobbyists camp out on their doorsteps and they write the bills
yep.
that they give to
yep.
them, and, you know, it's just...
Yep.
It's money speaks. But I think people have to speak up also, and because children are being abused, really. If you want, everybody talks about child abuse. But you know what? If a mother or a father were to feed formaldehyde, aluminum, and all the other toxins that are, and mercury, tamoxifen, to their child, you know, that child would be taken away by Child Protective Services for child abuse. And yet, legally,
yep.
somebody can pump it into their kid, and they go and they pay for it yet. There's
yeah.
something wrong
it
there.
It is crazy, no question about it. Catherine, I hate to cut you off here. We are actually out of time. But
sorry I took all
thank
your
you
time,
so much.
But I just...
No, not at all. Call back in any time. You raised really, really good points, and you do just absolutely wonderful work raising awareness on vaccines and other issues, and we're delighted to have you as a guest this evening. Please call back in again anytime.
Thank you, and good luck to you, Dr. Sayuri.
Good evening. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Well, Sherry, I'm going to go ahead and take us out here. We're at the end of our time. Unless there's anything you want to throw in real quick, I don't mean to cut you off either.
The only thing I want to say is if you're looking to find me, go to Facebook on Dr. Tenpenny on vaccines. Go to my website on vaccines, which is drtenpenny.com, and go to my website on my clinic, which is tenpennyimc.com.
And we appreciate having you here every week and look forward to next Monday night.
Thank you, Sherry, for letting people know where to find you. You've been listening to the Know Your Rights Hour. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, attorney Alan Phillips. We're here every Monday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, and rebroadcast proudly on naturalnewsradio.com Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. We'll see you next week, folks. Thanks for listening.